The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Kate Andrews, our economics editor, and I'm joined by Michael Simmons, our data editor. Michael, the biggest story of the week has got to be the borrowing costs for the UK government. Whilst it does seem like they peaked midweek and are back to where they were at the start of the month, we're still looking at incredibly painful figures for the government. Long-term borrowing costs at a 30-year high. They have surpassed where they were at the peak of Liz Truss's mini budget. What do you make of it?
It's a tiny bit of good news in that it started to go back down. Mm. But, you know, as you say, these are still, you know, near 30-year high prices for the cost of borrowing, which is not surprising when we have a chancellor that's delivered a budget that the markets don't seem to have faith in. But also, borrowing costs being this high is kind of not surprising when you look at the fact that the country's debt is basically worth 100% of the country's GDP. So when you're in a state like that as an economy, investors, lenders are not going to have faith in your country, you know, to lend to. So yes, it's a tiny bit of good news, but I mean, Rachel Reeves, I would say, is by no means out of any sort of woods. How do you think she's handled it this week?
She's had a surprisingly good week, given the situation is rather dire, as you say, even though it seems like borrowing costs for now have peaked. They're still substantially higher than what the Office for Budget Responsibility predicted around the budget. That is billions and billions of pounds that she has to find that she can't spend on what she might like to spend it on, but that she will need to service the debt. It's not a fun thing to pay off. It's money you've already spent. So I think it's a very tricky situation for her, but I was actually quite surprised how confident she was when she went into the House of Commons to answer questions about her trip to China. But what the opposition parties wanted to talk about was, of course, the borrowing costs and the state of the economy. She came in confident. She left confident. I think a big part of that is that Mel Stride, the shadow chancellor, really failed to land a blow. He tried, and other MPs tried. But one thing that was very clear is that the chancellor is still very happy to say that the former prime minister, Liz Truss, crash the economy, despite the fact that borrowing costs are higher than they were at the peak of the mini budget. This is a line Labour is going to continue to use. And Reeves made a calculation in the chamber that I think was correct, which is that the Tories are not going to defend that mini budget. They're not going to defend the fallout. They don't want to engage on that point. So she can keep saying it. And it allowed her to dodge a lot of the questions around what's happened under her own budget. I did a piece for Coffee House at the start of the week pointing out that Reeves and Truss have made a similar miscalculation. And that is that they thought that markets would see what they wanted to do in the medium term, invest, grow the economy, and that they'd finance it. And it doesn't appear to be the case. But there's another point here, Michael, which is that there are external factors at play, that Donald Trump and the threat of tariffs has seen borrowing costs go up for other countries too. But I think this is where the level of debt is so important. I mean, if level of debt in the UK were 60% of GDP or even 70%, it might be slightly different. But leaders now, whether it be the Prime Minister or the Chancellor, they have to calculate for those external events now. Sure, you can try to blame it on those factors, but ultimately you're the one who has to bear the cost.
Do you think, Kate, that the Bank of England has a role in this crisis, in that they themselves are continuing to sell off paper or sell off gilts in a reversal of the years of QE we've gone through?
Well, I think the Bank of England has to make corrections for what we saw during COVID and the role that they played in creating the inflation crisis. Now, look, it's really easy to point fingers in retrospect, but I think one of the biggest criticisms of central banks around the world, certainly at the Bank of England, is that they pretended that all that money printing wasn't going to have any kind of effect on the economy. And that was just so, so silly. So I think a correction has to take place. But where I think the bank is actually particularly nervous is more around what still pretty high interest rates mean for economic growth. It's fairly, the whole point of raising interest rates is to take heat out of the economy. And even though they're historically normal levels, they seem very high for where we've been. And I think the bank is realizing, or has realized, that it is playing a factor in the fact that the UK basically has no growth. And let's come on to that, because Michael, you made another great graph with the Spectator Data Hub this week. Looking at economic growth, we got the monthly figures for November, which showed 0.1% of growth. Now, it broke the dreadful cycle of contractions in October and September, but this is not good news.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is may as well not be growth. It's absolutely nothing to celebrate, although I'm sure that Rachel Reeves and the Labour government are relieved that, as you say, it's not a contraction. But I think we're going to need things to sort of drastically change if we're to get away from this sort of 0.1% level. And I guess the thing that just always depresses me is just comparing ourselves to America, who, you know, whatever America seemed to do, they grow. And then Britain's just stuck in the stagnation. And no one really seems to me to have any big idea of how we seriously get out of it.
And the way that people react is also quite different, isn't it? Because Joe Biden objectively had pretty good headline growth figures in America throughout his presidency. And yet Americans kept saying that the economy was their number one issue, that they were very worried about the future. We saw the election results. Clearly, there was quite a clear rejection of Bidenomics. In the UK, you just have prolonged stagnation. And yet it doesn't feel urgent. It doesn't feel like politicians in any party feel like they have to do something immediately, because it's not to say that I think Britons are okay with it, but as you say, it's more that nobody really wants to say out loud what might have to be done, because politically it's so difficult. And I wonder, you know, there are lots of benefits to parties changing in a democracy. It doesn't matter who you support or who you'd like to see win. There's benefit to having different parties in power just for the sake and health of being in a democratic society. I've thought to myself, it's really important for us all to understand that big problems in the UK have nothing to do with party politics, nothing to do even with a particular leader, that issues around healthcare and housing and the state pension, these are going to be huge things to tackle and really difficult to tackle regardless of who's in charge.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it comes down to, like, obviously, ultimately, it lays at the door of politicians and bankers and the people that run the economy. But ultimately, I think voters do play into this to the extent that if someone was to suggest, like, seriously pro-growth policies, for example, if we look at house building or just building in general, if we wanted to do, you know, serious deregulation that means we can build and become more productive, there will be hundreds of thousands of people who will object because they're worried about their view, or they're worried about the bats, or they're worried about the newts. And I think until, as a country, we, like, really get behind what's necessary for growth, then we will just continue with this stagnation that people are, as you say, they're not comfortable or happy with, but who knows any different? You know, it's what we've just become accustomed to.
Yeah, and especially around something like homes and house building, where there is that NIMBY tendency throughout the country to be very worried about the additional homes going up in your own backyard. And a lot of that is the fact that politicians, you know, throughout the decades have refused to listen to communities about what they would actually like in their backyard. For many people, they're very open to the idea of more homes, especially if it means their children and grandchildren can get on the housing ladder. But if they're ugly, then they're not going to like it very much at all. And that top-down approach, which is taken throughout the UK, again, around housing and healthcare, means that a lot doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. And I think, for me, there's such a missed golden opportunity when a lot of our current problems, and not sound like a broken record, in the economy, were started or made worse during the COVID lockdowns. Mm. And the COVID lockdowns could have been seen as a time to say, okay, now we can maybe start doing more building projects. We can do things that, maybe this is a bit anti-democratic, but we can do things that there would have been less resistance because of the state we were in. Like, we could have had this post-war attitude and said, right, we've just come through the biggest crisis, you know, for 75 years. We're going to properly rebuild our country just as we did after the Second World War. But I think, you know, we seem to have missed the boat on that.
It doesn't have to be anti-democratic. You can make the case. And it's very interesting, actually, that you talk about COVID, and we're both at risk of sounding like broken records, so we won't stay on it for too long. However, it's been interesting this week that the debate around the triple lock on the state pension has come up, because, of course, it was in those early years during COVID where the triple lock was suspended temporarily, because it became very clear that pensioners were about to benefit from a huge surge thanks to the triple lock, actually, because a lot of young people were losing their jobs at the bottom end of the pay spectrum because of lockdown. So it was going to be a really warped way of of dishing out that additional money. And now it's back in the news. You have hints from Labour, you have hints from the Tories that perhaps the triple lock isn't working as it should. That to me is like the perfect example of a policy where post-pandemic, there could have been a bipartisan push here where politicians could have said, it turns out this policy we created is not going to work under conditions that we never thought were possible, but came up anyway. Let's fix it. But of course, this is very naive of me because as we've seen this week, even though there does seem to be potentially cross-party consensus that this is something to tackle, they're still shouting at each other that the other's going to ruin the state pension.
Yeah, it's when I saw state pension in the news this week, I didn't even pay it much attention because I think it's this issue where everyone knows we can't afford it in even the medium term, let alone the long term. I think most people think it's like grossly unfair for the reasons you state. But it's such a popular policy among important core voter groups for both parties that neither of them are ever going to change it. Certainly not now when, as I say, they've missed that sort of bipartisan time that you talk about. They're not going to change it. So I just thought, none of this is serious. We're going to keep the triple lock. It's a shame. It upsets me, but hey.
It's hard to imagine abolish a triple lock being in either of the two parties' biggest manifestos leading into 2029, I agree. We have more graphs from you this week. Thank you, Michael. Check out the Spectator Data Hub to our viewers if it's not something that you're too familiar with. We have incredible graphs.
It's free.
From Michael and the data team, which include John and Sam. Inflation news was also updated this week. This is supposed to be the best story of the week, really, for the government, that inflation slowed to 2.5% in the 12 months leading up to November. That is slower than people had forecast, and it's pretty much now in line with the Bank of England's forecast that we had at the end of last year. It is expected inflation is going to rise to about 3% by the end of the year and then start falling again. It's above the bank's target, but not by much. The risk here, however, Michael, is that when those employer national insurance hikes come in, the OBR has calculated that those are going to be passed on almost completely to workers' wages in the form of slower pay raises, but also to consumer products. That's a big problem in and of itself. And then also, you've been looking into the numbers and you're skeptical overall.
If I can just show a graph that's on the Spectator Data Hub at the moment that's inspired by some work by Pantheon Economics, and this is, to get super technical, this looks at part of the basket of goods that the statisticians from the ONS go around and look at the prices when they're calculating inflation. And one of the key things is airfares. And what this graph shows is airfares based on the date in December that they were collected. And in this month's inflation figures, the date used for long-haul flights was early enough that it meant it was those people who were going travelling and returning before the sort of Christmas price hikes. Mm. And so what they've estimated is that if a later date had been chosen in the same month's figures, then it could have made as much as a 14 basis points difference to what inflation actually was. So it suggests that perhaps inflation numbers perhaps actually aren't as good as the ONS suggests.
And would we then see that in the following month's figures in December?
Yes, exactly. So it suggests that we're going to see a rebound next month.
That's very interesting. I think it's a very important reminder that monthly data can only tell us so much. But if we put it all together and if we look at the growth figures out this week, as we just discussed, okay, you had a tiny increase in GDP in November. But if you look at the 3 months leading up to November, there's no growth. And it does start to tell a story of stagnation. It does start to tell a story of inflation being a little more dicey than perhaps people think. But I don't know about you, Michael. I still think borrowing costs are going to be sort of the medium term biggest headache for this government, because whilst Rachel Reeves has handled the situation politically speaking quite well this week, what was also very telling is that the biggest questions that she decided to dodge earlier in the week around the state of the economy and around borrowing costs were the questions asked by her own party about what's going to happen with spending in the future. They kept setting her up to, you know, have a great moment. Isn't it great that the Labour Party hasn't returned to austerity? Isn't it great that we're not opting for spending cuts? And she very bluntly and clearly was just said, I'm going to stick to my fiscal rules. It wasn't like, oh, yes, no austerity. It was, no, I'm sticking to my fiscal rules. And it suggests that the spending review coming up this spring is going to be a very painful experience for her party.
Yeah, I think if I was a new Labour MP, I'd be very depressed, because most of these people came into politics at a time where, you know, they define themselves as the like anti-Osborne. We're in politics to be anti-austerity. And if the Labour Party is going to push forward with an economic plan that the markets will accept, I don't know about you, but I don't see a way where that doesn't include massive spending cuts. And so people that have come in, you know, define themselves as anti-austerity are going to find that at least the start of their Westminster political careers is going to be about delivering austerity.
I think what's so difficult for this government, and why in so many ways this parliament was always going to be a hospital pass, is you basically have two options with these fiscal rules. You either actually cut money, you cut spending, or you pretend you're going to cut spending. And multiple versions of the Conservative Party opted for the latter, pretending that in 5 years' time on this rolling forecast, there are going to be massive spending cuts. And it does feel like the markets have now seen through that. And Rachel Reeves's own budget, you know, the spending is front-loaded, and the idea is towards the end of the parliament, she's going to become much more austere. Nobody really believed that when the budget was published, but now it's very clear that markets aren't convinced. That means you have to go for that first option and actually implement some spending cuts. And that is where things will get really tricky and interesting.
What a happy time to be alive.
What a great time to be chatting to you, Michael.
Thank you.